Chapter 6, Opening Quote by Mother Teresa. If we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other. Chapter 6, Title. Forgiveness, a reckoning process that generates peace. I've come to appreciate how healing and forgiveness are inextricably intertwined, even in small, ordinary ways. I have to forgive every disappointment and interruption that interferes with my experience of the moment. Every time that I am told no by God, another person, or life itself, I have to actively forgive the world for things that not going the way that I had hoped. Then I can re-encounter the ever-present now. I re-establish peace in my world. One time I asked my mother, "Who's your best friend?" She replied, "Whomever I'm with at the moment." I liked that answer. I hope I can live out that wisdom. Similarly, I hope that I can answer the question, "What's your favorite thing to do?" with, "Whatever I'm doing right now." Then I'll know that I'm living in the now, and the key for doing so is forgiveness. I will be able to forgive the world for everything that is not, quote-unquote, now. Forgiveness can have very practical applications. I jog along a 2-mile rural road. Trash litters the edge of the road, corrupting its beauty. I frequently complained about the litter with a tightness in my jaw and neck as I did so. Then I realized that I had a choice. I could forgive the litter for being there and enjoy the landscape anyway, or I could pick up the litter. I decided on the latter. My garbage bag in hand, I picked up each can and wrapper. Initially, I was thinking mean thoughts about the litterers. Then I realized that I was littering my mind with resentment, robbing me of, quote-unquote, nowness. I switched to blessing each litterer and actually had great fun on the rest of my cleanup adventure. Forgiveness is like that. It transforms moments so I can live in the vitality of the now. Desmond is a Vietnam veteran who knew how to maintain peace in the now. During a QOL meeting with him, our team acknowledged his military service, which he appreciated. He said to us, "NAM vets never got their due." We offered an apology for the way he had been treated when he returned from the war. When asked how he was doing spiritually, he told us, "I'm good in that department because I always keep my feet wiped." He explained that some people don't keep their feet wiped on a daily basis. Instead, dirt accumulates, surfacing as they approach death, which was the case with Jim. Jim was a World War II vet. He was weak with a cancer that would take his life in a few days. After I introduced myself and we spoke quietly for several minutes about hospice care, I asked him if there was anything from the war that might still be troubling him. He said there was, but that he was too ashamed to say it out loud. Motioning me to come down close to him, he whispered in my ear, "Do you have any idea how many men I've killed?" I shook my head, remaining silent, steadily meeting his gaze with my own. He continued, saying, "Do you have any idea how many throats I've slit?" Again, I shook my head. The image was grim, and I felt my eyes begin to tear up. Jim was tearful, too. We sat silently together, sharing his suffering. No words needed to be said. This was a sacred moment that words would only corrupt. After several minutes, I asked, "Would it be meaningful if I said a prayer asking for forgiveness?" He nodded. I placed my hand on Jim's chest, anchoring his flighty, anxious energy with the security of my relaxed palm. My prayer, like any praying I do with patients, reflected no particular religion. I prayed, "Dear God, This man comes before you acknowledging the pain he has caused others. He has killed. He has maimed. He hurts with the pain of knowing what he did. He hurts with the pain of humanity. He comes before you now asking for forgiveness. He needs your mercy to restore his integrity. He comes before you saying, "Forgive me for the wrongs I have committed." Dear God, help him feel your saving grace. Restore this man to wholeness so he can come home to you soon. Amen. Jim kept his eyes closed for a moment, tears streaming down from unopened lids. Then he opened his eyes and smiled gratefully. His new sense of peace was almost palpable. It was a reminder to me of just how heavy guilt weighs. The reason I prayed for Jim with my hand on his chest is because anxious energy usually rises. Think about when you get excited. Your voice usually gets higher, energy gets flighty. You might place your hand on your chest or near your throat, unconsciously anchoring yourself. A calm, centered person's energy usually resides lower and deeper. If a calm person places his or her hand on an uncalm person's sternum, it can often help this person feel secure, more weighted, less anxious. I often sit with my dying patients with my hand on their chest. I teach their loved ones to do the same. It's tempting to try to soothe guilt away with rationalizations like, "That was a long time ago," or, "You were just obeying orders." This kind of rationalization doesn't help, however. These veterans know when and why they killed, and whether or not it violates their deepest held moral beliefs. They need to have the guilt acknowledged and accepted so that finally they can forgive themselves. Victims sometimes feel guilty. Their guilt might be irrational because the perpetrators have manipulated the victim to feel ashamed of the abuse. Jack was a hospice patient who sheepishly told me that he was worried about dying because, in his words, "I pissed on a priest's grave." I wasn't sure I heard him right, so I asked him, "You did what?" He said, "You heard me. I pissed on a priest's grave." I replied, "I'm guessing you had a good reason for doing that." He said, "He molested me when I was a boy." I could still see the pain in Jack's eyes from those long-ago days that had filled him with anger and shame. I leaned forward and looked deeply into his eyes, saying, "I'm glad you pissed on his grave, Jack. He deserved that." He looked at me suspiciously. "Do you really mean that?" I answered, "I do. I'm really glad you did that." Jack relaxed and said he felt relieved. I could only breathe deeply and let go of the outrage I felt toward the man who had violated him. Chapter subtitle: Responding to Guilt and Shame. If someone is unable to achieve forgiveness, they might arrive at the end of life filled with bitterness. Stockpiling transgressions of others, which is blame, or self, which is shame, is the recipe for making bitterness. Bitterness is a poison that contaminates even the most innocent heart. It is a venom for the soul. I believe forgiveness is essential because it brings peace with the past. Although it's true that we cannot change the past, we can change our relationship to the past, and forgiveness is the means to that end. In fact, I heard Oprah Winfrey say that forgiveness is, quote, "giving up the hope that the past can be any different than what it was," end of quote. The dictionary defines the word forgive as, quote, "to give up resentment against or the desire to punish," end of quote. For me, forgiveness is simply being willing to open my heart again to a person, a situation, or myself. A closed heart blocks the energy of my larger self. Blocked energy is a significant loss for two reasons. One, The person who slighted me now controls my heart and its ability to love. And two, I've shut myself off from the energy of the spiritual dimension where solutions for resolving the trouble in the relationship can occur. In this context, I can now understand the biblical admonition to love your neighbors and pray for those who persecute you. I no longer see this as a selfless act, but rather as a means of staying connected with my own vitality. This does not mean that I don't stand up for myself, set boundaries, or keep the person from controlling me. Rather, praying for someone who has hurt me, that is, keeping my heart open to them, keeps me from losing my own self. It keeps the other person from controlling my heart and its ability to love fully. I can then set boundaries with an open heart. Sometimes people resist doing the work of forgiveness because they think it will then condone what was done to them. I tell them, what happened is still wrong. It will never be okay. But until you achieve forgiveness, that act, as awful as it is still controlling you. You are locking up the part of you that is hurting, and that part of you desperately wants to come home. I also explain how forgiveness is a process that often has to be done incrementally over time. It doesn't just happen with a snap of your fingers. I explain how the process starts with a willingness to forgive and develops into an intention to do so. This step is the most crucial and also the one most vulnerable to omission because of self-deception. People say they want to forgive, but their actions may belie their stated motive. Their intention is to maintain the grudge. If the person has a spiritual orientation, I often simply ask them to start the process by praying for a willingness to forgive. If spirituality has no meaning, or if the word forgive has an unwanted religious connotation, I usually speak in terms of holding on to something versus letting it go. Often I assign a simple homework assignment to write down the words, I am willing to forgive blank. And in the blank, you would put your own name or the name of someone or a situation. And then you write, and I intend to do it. Then you would tape this onto a mirror and say it out loud each day. This act helps people change their minds about their intention to let go of a hurt or disappointment so the forgiveness process can begin. When someone persistently fails to forgive in spite of attempts to do so, I explore the purpose that non-forgiveness serves and the role it might be playing in sabotaging their efforts. This role might include receiving sympathy for the victim role, or staying safely stuck in powerlessness so that no risk is taken to assume responsibility for their needs or to ask for their needs to be met. Asking people to consider forgiveness without pressuring them is important. There is no need to be pushed into the forgiveness process. Demanding forgiveness is seldom effective. It's more a matter of staying open to the possibility. This is not as easy as it sounds. Because I've seen peace come to people when they do the work of forgiveness, I've developed a bias toward wanting everyone to do it. I have to resist imposing my bias on others, remembering that people may not be able, ready, or willing to forgive. I not only need to accept their decision, I need to understand and respect it. My job is to encourage them to consider forgiveness, but I have to be careful that I do not judge them if they decline. When I don't completely respect their decision, small inflections in my voice or changes in my posture give me away. The person experiences my judgmental attitude and withdraws. As a result, opportunities to help them consider forgiveness at some future time are lost. This loss is significant. I might open the door to forgiveness, and the patient declines to enter. This reaction doesn't mean they don't want to forgive. It often means they are not yet ready. When I initially see patients to discuss forgiveness, they might not be interested. As death approaches, however, I often remind them about the possibility of forgiveness, and often they are then ready, willing, and able. It's also important not to rush people into forgiveness prematurely. I heard a presenter at a hospice conference say, quote, "Forgiveness should not come until guilt has moved us into remorse. Remorse is realizing how our action hurt others. Otherwise, forgiveness is just a self-indulgent, guilt-relieving device that does not lead toward compassion." End of quote. The presenter was right. I've had the same experience. I do something wrong, and rather than abide my guilt so I can use it to meet the part of myself that committed the wrong, I ask for forgiveness so that I don't have to reckon with the part of myself that caused me to wrongly act in the first place. Premature forgiveness gets me off the hook of remorse so that I don't have to take responsibility for my actions. Forgiveness does not require reconciliation. In fact, reconciliation should sometimes be avoided. For example, an abused wife still needs to forgive her husband, but she should not reconcile with him to be abused again. Unfortunately, premature forgiveness often plays a role in abuse cycles. I tell people who keep reconciling with an abuser, quote, "Believe your eyes, not your ears. I'm sorry doesn't count until you see their actions change for the good, and their actions aren't going to change unless they are getting help. Until then, you need to focus on loving and taking care of the part of you that is hurt and wounded by them." End of quote. I make this sound simple, but it's not. It's easier to believe the illusion that the unhealthy person will change than it is to do the work of meeting our own interior hero who awaits permission to love the broken part of us back home into psychological health. Physician Scott Peck writes about guilt in his book, The Road Less Traveled. He identifies what he calls, quote-unquote, disorders of responsibility spectrum. People on one end of the spectrum don't assume enough responsibility for hurting actions. When there's conflict in the relationship, it's the other person's fault. They often feel that they don't need to apologize for anything. Statements such as, "What you see is what you get," or, "That's just how I am," are their way of saying that they have no intention of changing, accommodating, or apologizing. Relieving them of guilt without exploring it means that they never develop a sense of remorse, and they miss the gift of guilt. To tell such people, "You were doing the best you could," or "It's not your fault," when something goes awry, only reinforces their reluctance to accept responsibility. Instead, guiding people toward realizing the impact of their actions on others can birth compassion, generating apology and forgiveness. Eric was such a patient. He assumed too little responsibility for his actions. His health was failing, and he was scared he might die. We were having a QOL meeting with Eric, exploring his fears. He revealed that he had belonged to a motorcycle gang. He said, "I watched lots of women get gang raped." I was struck by Eric's lack of emotion. I asked him about the effect these acts had on the women. He didn't know, remaining more focused on his guilt than on their pain. He showed little remorse, so he was unable to elaborate. When we closed the meeting, the patient requested a hope for the day. When my turn came, I fought to abide in my non-judgmental self so that I could sincerely appeal to a sense of compassion that Eric seemed to lack. Telling us what he did indicated that he might be ready to take responsibility for his actions. He couldn't feel the pain of what he had done, but if I stayed open and connected to him, maybe I could feel his pain for him. Later, he could feel that pain for himself. So with emotion, I said, "My hope for you this day is that you reflect on what you did to the women that you watched getting raped so that you can understand the pain you caused by witnessing their harm without stopping it. My hope is that you will let yourself feel the pain of those women, not for their sakes, but for your own, so you can sincerely feel remorse and ask for forgiveness." I then offered that at some point he could think about doing something especially nice for a woman so that those raped women's suffering would not have been in vain. Eric looked me in the eyes, gave me a slight nod of his head, and said, "Thank you." I'm not naive enough to think that what I said produced an aha moment for this man. Neither am I cynical enough to think that my words had no impact. Chapter subheading, Self-Forgiveness. Unlike Eric, who assumed too little responsibility, some people assume too much. They are on the other end of Peck's disorders of responsibility spectrum. When there is conflict in their world, they not only shoulder their own guilt, but also everyone else's. When something goes wrong, they assume that they're at fault. They drown in remorse, or more accurately, false remorse, taking on guilt that isn't theirs. They need encouragement to let go of inappropriate guilt, and they need to practice self-forgiveness. Peck's disorders of responsibility spectrum is not quite as straightforward as it sounds. I notice that many people, including myself, can be on different ends of the spectrum in varying aspects of their lives. For example, a person may be overly responsible at work, accepting blame for anything that goes wrong in their department, but assume too little responsibility in their personal relationships, or vice versa. One crucial component of self-forgiveness is learning to distinguish guilt from shame. Guilt is natural and designed to provide feedback so we can learn important lessons. Shame is artificially created and designed to punish. Guilt tells us something that we did is wrong, guiding us toward more compassionate actions of others. Shame tells us that we are wrong, filling us with worthlessness and consuming our self-compassion. Guilt mobilizes us into new behaviors. Shame immobilizes us so that we remain stuck. People are often filled with shame. We need to go from shame to guilt before we can get to forgiveness. The formula, quote, "admit it, quit it, forget it," end of quote, helps self-forgiveness. This formula can also provide clues about a person's orientation on Peck's responsibility spectrum. People who have a hard time accepting responsibility are reluctant to admit or quit the behavior, whereas people who take on too much responsibility have a hard time forgetting. Ed, one of our hospice volunteers, is a good example of people who take on too much responsibility when something goes wrong. Ed was visibly upset when he asked to speak with me. He said, "I've been sitting with Mr. Zielinski. The phone rang and I went out to answer it. When I came back, he had died." Just talking about what had happened escalated Ed's anxiety. I said, "Are you saying that you knew Mr. Zielinski was going to die in the few minutes that you stepped away, and so you said to yourself, 'Oh, goody, here's my chance to let this man die alone'?" Ed said, "No, I didn't know he was going to die right then." I replied, "Good. For a minute, I was starting to think that you thought you were God and that you were omniscient and that you could have predicted the exact moment Mr. Zielinski was going to die." Ed laughed. "No, I don't want to be God." I replied, "Then are you willing to forgive yourself for being human and not being able to predict the future?" Ed said he was. Then he smiled and expressed relief. Helping people like Ed develop an appropriate relationship with guilt is like separating wheat from chaff, sorting out what to hold on to, what to let go of, what is realistic and what is unrealistic, what is their business and what is not. As Peck says, quote, "What we are and what we are not responsible for in this life is one of the greatest problems of human existence. It is never completely solved, and it requires continual assessment and reassessment." End of quote. Chapter subtitle, Forgiveness Pitfalls, Enabling and False Forgiveness. Enabling is a passive process that fails to hold someone accountable for how their actions impact us. Rather than acknowledge how we've been hurt, We avoid our feelings by letting the transgressor off the hook. Being overly forgiving of others keeps the hurt aspect of self exiled, reinforcing the original betrayal. An opportunity for the transgressor to grow is also averted. For example, parents who don't require their children to be respectful and responsible, quote-unquote, forgive their child's actions too easily. Forgiveness turns into enabling, perpetuating the child's behaviors. Meanwhile, the parent ignores their own feelings of anger, hurt, and disappointment. Forgiveness can unknowingly be faked. A person might say, "I let that go a long time ago," or, "It's over and forgotten." Sometimes that's true. At other times, it's a way to fool ourselves so we can sidestep the work of forgiveness. I know, because I'm guilty of practicing false forgiveness myself. It's a convenient way of lying to myself. The most common mistake that leads to false forgiveness is that the wrong part of the self is trying to do the forgiveness work. For example, we can think of ourselves as having a core self that is whole and healthy. If someone is abused, a part of the self is torn away from the core self. It is the part of self that has been betrayed that needs to do the forgiving, and it can't do that if it's left split off from consciousness. Disconnected from the core self, the abused self is left exiled in hurt, anger, and shame. It is the exiled part of self that has been transgressed. The forgiveness process begins by reintegrating the exiled self back into the conscious self. Then forgiveness can be extended. Unfortunately, people often mistakenly omit this step. The conscious self does not feel the hurt, anger, and shame that the violated self feels. So it's understandable that people can easily deceive themselves into thinking, "I let that go." Doing forgiveness work, however, without first integrating the wounded self is especially damaging because it leaves the wounded self exiled. It leaves the wounded self saying, "Wait a minute, I'm the one who is damaged. I'm the one who is left hurt and angry. You can't speak for me unless I'm present. You can't speak for me until you re-own me and welcome me back home." Thus, the conscious self lacks the authority to offer forgiveness unless it first opens up to the pain and anger of the part of self that was betrayed and split off. It is only the betrayed self's voice that has the authority to extend true forgiveness. If left exiled by the conscious self, the wounded self is forced to seek attention unconsciously, which is a more arduous, lengthy, and less effective path toward wholeness that can be filled with many pitfalls. When I counsel adult children whose parent beat or sexually abused them, I never accept at face value that they have forgiven the offender. I explore the basis for forgiveness, and I often find a facade that hides the abused self. When I confront the facade, unwanted feelings of pain, anger, and shame often surface as the exiled self gains voice. Sometimes a list of excuses condones the abuse so that the facade can be maintained. Excuses like, "My mom was abused when she was little too. She didn't know any better." Sadly, the abused person now perpetuates the original betrayal by silencing the aspect of his or herself that was hurt. This kind of toxic relationship sacrifices healthy personal growth to protect the parent. The work that I do with adult children is to encourage them to touch their anger and hurt and coax it out of hiding so it can be used to take a stand with the parent. This healthy stand allows the adult child to develop his or her own personhood. Taking a stand is important because it allows the person to develop their own internal parent who can love and protect them. The abuser may then respond by accusing the child of being, quote-unquote, selfish or self-centered as a means of controlling the relationship so it can return to its former toxicity. Ironically, just the opposite is occurring. The adult child is becoming self-full, full of self. Once they grow into themselves, guilt-inducing accusations can no longer control them. Once the hurt self is reintegrated into the conscious self, then the abused child can forgive the abuser. Once forgiveness occurs, the abuser no longer controls the abused. Chapter subheading, Never Too Late to Forgive. To withhold forgiveness means to cut myself off from a compelling force deep in the soul that seeks it. If that forgiving force is denied, vitality and peace remain elusive. Forgiveness restores wholeness. It gives us back the part of self that has suffered the transgression. Although some people have powerful defense mechanisms to resist forgiveness, most just need a little encouragement. Such was the case with the family of a 38-year-old patient, Kevin. We gathered at Kevin's bedside for a QOL meeting with the family. His mother said, "I just can't sit by and watch him die. I just can't." She repeatedly protested, as if to convince herself. Meanwhile, Kevin's father babbled mechanically about anything except that his son was dying. Instead, his father told us that the weather was going to change and that there was a new movie coming out. I told them that we were on a very short timeline. I explained the value of preparing for Kevin's death and ways that they might participate. At first, they resisted. His father continued to talk about the weather. With some coaxing, however, his mother gradually started letting go of the illusion that Kevin wasn't going to die, and she opened up to the reality that he was. His mother said, "His sister wants to come, but they've been estranged for 15 years. She doesn't even know why. He doesn't want to see her. Should we tell her to come?" I polled the team for their opinions. Everyone had a different answer, and we weren't sure what to do. Kevin's condition was deteriorating, so we knew an answer could not wait. Finally, we told them to have the sister come, and we would have a nurse in attendance. If Kevin showed any sign of agitation or desire not to see his sister, she would have to leave. Our team struggled with that decision. How do we measure the needs of the brother against those of the sister? How do we measure the rights of the dying against the rights of the living? How do we measure the patient's verbalized desire to maintain walls of isolation with experience that tells us that he might need reconciliation to achieve peace? How do we measure what is our agenda as both professionals and human beings against the patient's agenda that had been explicitly stated? Were we violating Kevin's rights by letting his sister visit? Were we dishonoring his need for control and self-determination? When Kevin's sister came that evening, one of the nurses, Cherie, accompanied her. Cherie whispered in his ear, "Your sister is here." Although he had been unconscious for a few days, his eyes opened. He smiled, holding out his hand to his sister. Then he lapsed back into unconsciousness and died peacefully an hour later. Helping Kevin and his family let go of the fears that kept them holding on, and then helping them open up to saying their goodbyes and doing the work of forgiveness brought them peace. To facilitate this process, we have to let go of the assumption that the person always knows best and open up to our experiences that have taught us what helps. Otherwise, others don't gain the benefit of our experience. At the same time, we have to let go of our presumption that we know what's best for others and open up to ways that we don't. It's tempting to think that because this story had a good ending, that we acted correctly. The truth is, I don't know. I can only hope so. Often there's no way to know if a decision was correct. By letting go of my need to be right and opening up to ways I make mistakes, I become more teachable. However, I often resist learning the errors of my ways. Sometimes I push too hard. Sometimes not enough. I try to remain sensitive to my weaknesses and stay aware of how they interfere with my judgment. I went to see a patient whose wife, Emily, wanted to be present when I met with her husband, Adam. I was told that she didn't want the word hospice used with Adam because she didn't want him to know he was dying. I deal with these kinds of situations often, and I have found that it's usually better for the patient to know, so I disregarded Emily's warning. Emily was not at the bedside, so I met with Adam alone and initiated a discussion about his approaching death. He told me he was relieved to be able to talk about it. I left, smugly patting myself on the back for proceeding without Emily's quote-unquote interference. The next time I visited Adam, Emily was present. I introduced myself and she stiffened. She snapped at me saying, "Please leave now and don't come talk to me or my husband again." There was no bridging the gap that I had created by disregarding her previous desire to protect her husband. Whatever benefit Adam got from our discussion, it was undone by the pain I caused his wife. Eventually, Adam came to the hospice unit and died. I had to remain outside his circle of care. A few months later, I saw Emily again, this time at the hospital's memorial service that we hold for the families of patients who die at our hospital. She saw me too, and she glared from her fourth row seat in the auditorium. When I took the microphone to welcome people to the service, I could feel her piercing gaze. After a few opening remarks, I spoke about how we strive to serve and how we sometimes fail. I then looked directly at Emily and I said, "Mrs. Mann, I know I made a mistake in not listening to your desires for your husband. I realize my action increased the suffering you were already feeling. I just want you to know I'm very sorry for having done that to you." She hesitated for a moment, then nodded her head and uncrossed her arms. Seeking forgiveness with Mrs. Mann followed a rather ordinary course of events. Sometimes, however, circumstances surrounding forgiveness can be downright bizarre. Such was the case with a patient who was a minister. He asked us to call him Reverend. He said it made him feel part of the team, allowing him to keep his identity. Reverend and his wife Libby were devoted to each other as together they faced his death on our hospice unit. After a lifetime of church ministry, Reverend maintained his desire to serve others. One day, his roommate died. The roommate's wife was crying softly nearby. The nurse asked Reverend if he would like to leave the room. He said, "No, I'm right where I'm supposed to be." He then offered solace to the wife. Reverend was a man of modesty and dignity. He wanted prayer when he awakened. He enjoyed leading prayer during QOL meetings at his bedside. Reverend was able to chide us and do so openly. A nurse, Pat, told him, "I'll be back in a minute." When she returned an hour later, he lightly asked her, "Do you know the 6 most common words said in a hospital?" Pat acknowledged that she didn't. He said, "I'll be back in a minute." "Hospital minutes are the longest minutes in the world," he said. They both laughed, and Pat apologized for its truism. Reverend's son was a music director at a church. We borrowed a keyboard so he could play at his dad's bedside. They sang hymns together. The son's voice had a richness that filled the unit with heavenly sounds. Although things seemed to be going well, Reverend and his family had ambivalent feelings about receiving care from the VA. A few years previously, he had suffered a serious complication that occurred during surgery. Reverend had demanded an investigation. A feeling of distrust understandably tainted our team's relationship. One evening, a surgeon, Dr. McChesney, came to the unit to see a patient. She heard Reverend's son playing the keyboard and singing with Reverend. Dr. McChesney later told me that they sounded like angels, and so she went into the room to check it out. I can only imagine Dr. McChesney's shock when she came face to face with the man who had been her accuser just a few years before. Not knowing what to do and at a loss for words, Dr. McChesney later told me that she stood there immobilized. Libby came to her side, and Dr. McChesney braced herself for an assault. Instead, she got a warm greeting. Reverend called from his bed, saying to her, "I've been praying for you to come." Dr. McChesney apologized for what had happened to Reverend as a result of her action. Reverend told her, "I'm so glad you came. I wanted you to know that it wasn't entirely your fault." Dr. McChesney was still tearful when she came back to the nurse's station, telling me what had happened. She said, "It's a miracle. I haven't been on this unit for years. I came to see a different patient. I just went in there to see where the beautiful music was coming from." She kept shaking her head in disbelief, and then she said, "You have no idea how this has weighed on my mind." I responded, "It sounds like it doesn't need to weigh there any longer." She smiled with obvious relief. The next morning, the QOL team gathered at Reverend's bedside with his family. It was fascinating to hear them recount the events of the previous evening. Reverend said, "I had been praying for the past 2 weeks for Dr. McChesney to come. I knew I needed to release her spiritually from the investigation. I wasn't sure how to get in touch with her, but I just knew she'd come." I responded, "It's a testament to the power of a dying man's prayer. It's a testament to the power of accusing someone and yet staying open to her. Your bad experience didn't close you off from her goodness. I'm not sure I could do that. I'm going to let you inspire me." Reverend self-effacedly brushed my comment off. I continued, "Actually, I don't know who to admire more, you and your courage to forgive, or Dr. McChesney and her humility in wanting to be forgiven." The son interjected, saying, "Healing requires both." He expressed gratitude to the team for the healing environment that had been created, saying, "The love and care here have erased all the past mistakes made with us." Reverend, his family, and Dr. McChesney helped me understand that forgiveness may be one of the most difficult things we do, and not doing it may be the most foolish.